So I will thank you very much for including this talk. There's actually a relationship between this talk and the previous one, as you will see. And has to do with dimensions of gauge fields. In the previous talk, the gauge field had dimension 2, which posed problems in constructing covariant derivatives. This work has been done with a math colleague of mine, Gabriele Lanave, and one of my students who just finished Kritsangapong Limtrigal. Okay, so I'm going to put this work in the broadest context, and some of you have heard various versions, but you haven't heard this version. Okay, so let's just review standard electricity and magnetism. Standard electricity and magnetism is a one form which has dimension 1, and this local gauge transformation manifests itself as in a conserved quantity. The current and the gauge field enter the action in this fashion. And as a result, if you undergo this transformation, the F part, of course, remains invariant. This does not. And from that, you demand that you don't want this term. So you want the system to be invariant. And you get this conserved current. And that's Noether's first theorem. Okay, now this will come into play later on. So this is gauge invariance implies this conserved current. And because this has dimension 1, this is dimensionless, so it's a gauge theory, A has to have dimension 1. And this also fixes the dimension of the current, because this term right here has to have dimension 0, which means the current has dimension d minus 1. So that's standard electricity and magnetism. A is dimension 1, the current has dimension d minus 1. Okay, so the question I want to ask is, are there any exceptions to this? Okay, so and are there ways of understanding them in general? Okay, so the thing I want to do is look at this paper by, since this is a conference on which you combine high and low energy, I'm going to introduce superconductivity by looking at this paper. I mean, by the treatment presented in this paper. Okay, now, there are probably other ways of doing this, but I think this is the simplest way of doing this. And the nice thing about this is that he puts a particular physical problem in a fairly general theoretical context. And the physical problem is the problem that Pipard faced. So Pipard was trying to understand how it is possible for the penetration depth to depend on the mean free path in a superconductor. Because if you look at the London equation has no dependence on anything besides fundamental constants, mass, charge, speed of light. There is no dependence on the mean free path. And so from that, Pipard deduced that, in fact, the current inside a superconductor does not look like this. In fact, what he decided is that it's something rather non-local. Okay, now we can understand this non-locality as just a very general consequence of breaking U1 down to Z2. So in a superconductor...
Sorry, can I interrupt you for a second? Can you go back one slide? So the symbols in the equation are...
The what?
The various symbols...
This is just the speed of light.
Okay.
This is this parameter here.
A is the vector potential.
A is the vector potential, okay. Which is sourcing the magnetic field.
Meaning the magnetic field is the curl of that.
Yeah. Right. Okay, so what he did is the following. Pipard was an experimentalist, and what he did is he sprinkled tin impurities up to 3% on, I forgot which superconductor he had. Let's say it's aluminum, okay? And what he noticed is that the penetration depth changed as you changed the number of impurities in the system. Okay? And there's no dependence like that in this expression. So his question was, how do you explain this effect? Okay. How many of you know about the Picard kernel? Okay. Okay, at least one person, okay? Okay, so, I mean, this is sort of standard. It's mentioned in Tinkham's book, but it's just mentioned. So the sort of general way in which we think about this is that inside a superconductor, since there is no flux, there is no magnetic field, it has to be the case that the phase, which is now just parameterized in this coset group, so if you look at the integral of this along a closed loop, this would give you the flux, which is just phi, and hence this quantity is equal to zero inside a superconductor. So if that's equal to zero, the stable equilibrium inside a superconductor is just this condition, which is really the condition of zero magnetic field or zero flux. So if this is the zero, if this is the stable equilibrium, you can construct a Landau theory by expanding around this minimum. And hence the matter part of your action is just given up to second order with some general kernel here and these terms right here. Okay? Okay. The current then is just the derivative of the matter part of the action with respect to A. And this kernel is now some general kernel of X and X prime, and that's the actual relationship between J and A. And what Picard noticed is that if he picked this to be this function, well, this is now some function of the mean free path, he in fact could explain his data. Okay, there's no reason why you should see this as being obvious, but this is what he came up with. It's a fairly non-local kernel. So the actual relationship between J and A is not point-like. Is that J depends everywhere in space on what the vector potential is. Okay, but it's just a general consequence of expanding around a local minimum in which there is, in which it's the zero flux condition for the bulk of the system.
Okay. What is psi here, the coherence length?
C does depend. No, C, this quantity here, depends on the scattering time or the scattering length of the system.
What's the meaning of the length scale?
So this length scale here is the, okay, so it's set by the number of impurities in the system. It's not the coherence length, okay? So what he's saying is that inside a superconductor, there are a couple of length scales which the current has to know about relative to the gauge field. And if that is the case, you have to have a non-local relationship. Okay, and in fact, it's the non-locality of C which really tells you about the Meissner effect. If you just look at the action that I had there and look at just what, if you just do dimensional counting, you have to have the dimension of C. This will now be the mean free path. And then this is just now the length of the volume of the system, A squared. That translates, if you write this in terms of B, it would just look like this. If you just look at the expulsion energy, well, just B squared times the volume. So the Meissner effect can just be understood quite simply as a particular condition on this kernel. Namely, that this quantity here is much bigger than one. Okay? Okay, so this kernel is incredibly important in understanding the Meissner effect, and it's non-local. Okay, now let's look at the units of the current. The current coming from here, you can just read off these units. This has dimension d, whatever the dimension of this quantity is, and dA, which of course is equal to one. But the important thing is that it's not d minus 1. It's whatever the dimension here is. And as a result, this has an anomalous dimension. The standard case from what I've already told you, is just d minus 1. Okay, so underlying then the current inside a superconductor is actually a quantity which does in fact deviate from the standard dimension. And what I want to do is understand how this happens, because it's not consistent with the standard electricity and magnetism. And I want to see if there are other examples in which this sort of thing happens. And in a superconductor, of course, you've broken U1 down to Z2. And I want to ask the question, is that the general way in which you can have currents which deviate from the standard scaling? Yes.
So this C that you're considering now is general, or it's again parts one, because it seems to me that the dimension of DC is fixed by the dimension of the gauge field. So that
C is not, it's fixed by what best fits the data.
Okay.
I mean, it's just some function of R.
So, but for the previous kernel that you had, you still have that the current has dimension D minus one, right?
No, it has D minus the dimension of C minus one. If you just look at this right here.
Right. I'm talking about when you fix C to be the Pippard's one.
The Pippard one doesn't have dimension zero. Okay, if you just look at this current here, the current here has dimension this.
What if I look at the first equation? Shouldn't the Lagrangian have fixed dimensions?
Yeah. So what you can do is put something out as a running constant out in front, but that would then affect the charge, but we know what the charge quantization is inside a superconductor. It's because it has to have fixed dimension that this quantity right here is sort of problematic.
I'll ask you again.
Okay. So the combination is J times A, but the relationship that you have, if you have this non-local kernel, is not exactly that. Okay, yes.
What do we know? I mean, besides Pippard's experiment, what do we know experimentally about constraints, and how well do we know C?
How well do we know C?
Is that even a meaningful question?
No, that's an extremely meaningful question. High temperature superconductors. I don't think we know much about C.
I mean, so it now enters the London equation. Non-local London.
Don't think about London. This is the equation you should think about. The London equation doesn't work. This is the equation that works.
London equation, I don't mean J equals to A. I mean the whole thing, the non-local one.
Yeah, the non-local one, yes. That's right. Right. It affects all of the equations, okay? But it's a general, you are allowed this kernel by the general consideration of U1 going down to Z2.
And here, by the dimension of things, including J, you really mean the RG sense, in the scaling sense.
Right. So we know that conserved quantities can't change under RG. Their dimension is just fixed by the engineering dimension. So it's in that sense that I mean.
So you're saying you have a violation of that?
Yes. That's right. Okay. So my point right here is that there isn't a well-known example in nature in which the standard rules of electricity and magnetism dictate that the current in A enjoy a non-local relationship. And I want to give you other examples in which this is true. And I want to come up with a unified way of understanding all of these.
But can I ask, so is C a local function? In a sense of if I Fourier transform it at small q, it's just a, it's a constant.
No, it's k to some power.
Okay,
it's k to some power.
If you take it to be k to some power, then it will be non-trivial DC. But if it's k to a zero power, it's small.
Right. But that's okay. So even in
some non-locality, it doesn't matter. It won't will still correspond to d sub c being zero.
Right. Certainly. Yeah. So.
Claiming,
that's right.
Mentally, you're claiming that there's physical systems where c
right.
is non-trivial k. Dependent.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes.
So ordinary superconductors, are you saying ordinary superconductors have non-trivial C in this sense?
Can you just wait?
Okay.
I'm not saying that ordinary superconductor. The thing of it is, this Pippard kernel is very hard to measure. Okay, and or should I just say C in general is hard to measure. We certainly know that to explain tin in, you know, standard metallic low TC superconductors, this funky thing that he wrote down with R to the fourth seems to work fairly well. What it is for YBCO, I asked my experimental colleagues, they can't tell me what it is.
But the C that Pippard took, it was short-range function, right?
But it's one over R to the fourth.
No, but with the exponential kernel.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So, okay, so if you look at, right, there is this exponential part, but you can still generate something that's consistent with a penetration, with a London penetration depth, even with this 1 over R to the fourth out in front. Okay? That's the key point. And Weinberg's point is that it's really dictated by, you know, if the interactions are fairly short range, then C will also be fairly short range. Mm-hmm. But it's really determined by the kinds of interactions you have in the system. And that's really what my focus is on in these sorts of non-local relationships between J and A. Mm-hmm. Okay? Okay. Okay, so the problem of anomalous dimensions for conserved quantities comes up in the context of trying to construct theories for the strange metal. Okay, now I have two numbers here, zero and infinity, and those are the number of theories that have been constructed in each of these regimes. And the reason why this number is so small is the following. There is no order, so you don't quite know what to do. But let me just give you the experimental facts on the strange metal that you're trying to understand. You're trying to understand why this frequency this power is different from one over here, and you're also trying to understand a possible deviation from the Wiedemann-Franz law. Okay, so why is this problem hard? So this problem is hard because if you assume all these power laws are due to some kind of underlying criticality, and you assume that this criticality is the simplest kind that we understand, namely everything is governed by one length scale, then you can easily go and just scale the singular part of the free energy, and you'll see in general that you have these sorts of power laws. And no, this is always the negative of this. But in the cuprates, this is supposed to be minus 2/3, and that's 1. So no amount of fiddling can ever make this number minus 2/3 and that one 1. Okay, now the problem is even more complicated than that. It's that if this really is 2 minus d over z, and you're trying to get this, say we're just trying to explain this part of the problem. Okay, what kind of z would you need? If the system is three-dimensional? Well, to make this one, you'd actually have to have a negative z. So this whole single parameter construction just fails. Okay, And it also fails if you were to sort of change, say, the reason this is 2 is this is 2 because it's 2 dA, but it's, dA is 1. So in either case, it doesn't solve the problem. Or maybe it would in one case, but not the other. Okay, so this doesn't work. Okay, now, a few years ago, there has been a proposal that all of the properties of the strange metal can be explained. This is a purely phenomenological paper. If you introduce an additional length scale, and this length scale is that the current has an anomalous dimension. Okay, forget about theta right now, just the current has an anomalous dimension. And that's the current that's being sourced by this gauge field. And this gauge field doesn't have dimension 1, it has dimension 1 minus phi. And phi is not epsilon, it's in fact minus 2/3. So the dimension of the gauge field is in fact 5/3. Okay. The actual claim is this. So the fundamental thing is A, and everything that A is related to picks up this anomalous dimension, the E field and the B field. So B does not have dimension 2. Now the fact that B doesn't have dimension 2 is problematic, because we know that the flux is pi r squared B. Well, if this doesn't have dimension 2, then A dot dl can no longer be the flux. So this is very weird electricity and magnetism. What I'd like to do is try to understand what might be a possible way of how this can come about, and then I'll show the relationship between that and the Tapard construction. Okay, so the key sort of physics point right now is this statement right here. Okay, so how is this possible? Okay, now the first thing to note is that if A doesn't have dimension 1, and you're sticking with a gauge theory, it's impossible for this to be true, because lambda has to be dimensionless. There's no quick fix by making lambda have dimensions, okay? Or in a trivial sense. Okay, so what we need to do is look at some possible ways how we might be able to generalize electricity and magnetism. Okay, now there's a hint as to how we might proceed. If we just look at this statement, which is Noether's first theorem, this statement, it turns out, is ambiguous. Because this statement is ambiguous up to any operator that commutes with the exterior derivative. In other words, if I can come up with an operator that I can sandwich between here and here, I haven't changed the form of the conservation law, but I can use this operator to change the dimensions of what I mean by the current. Okay? And this can be subsumed into redefinition of the current, and hence the current will have whatever dimension this object has, and in fact, it can be defined in this way. Okay. So if there's a non-trivial operator that does that, I can, in fact, have a new current. Now, what we need to do is see how this comes about from a generalized, from some sort of new gauge transformation. Okay, if we're looking at gauge transformations, let's just look at where gauge transformations come from. Well, they come from things that keep this quantity invariant. So let's just look at this in momentum space. And it's well known, this is in Peskin's book, that in fact this matrix here has a zero eigenvector. So if you multiply this by k nu, this thing is equal to zero. Okay, and this is just exactly this transformation, and hence the family of gauge transformations is just determined by the zero eigenvectors of this equation. Okay, now if this is a zero eigenvector equation, I will not change the value of the right-hand side by multiplying by some function f. Okay, which means there is an extended family of gauge invariant theories in which FK plays the role of the gauge transformation. Okay, so this is now the generator of the symmetry. Now, if it's a generator of the symmetry, there have to be certain constraints that we have on F. It should be rotationally invariant, A is still a one form, and this commutator has to be equal to zero. Okay, if it's rotationally invariant, the only choice is that F is K squared. Okay? In real space, that manifests itself as just the Laplacian raised to some arbitrary power, which means that there is a general class of electromagnetisms which transform in this way. And all of these have non-local relationships, or at least non-local gauge transformations. And hence, they will, in fact, have non-local relationships between the current and the vector potential. Okay, so what kinds of theories have this behavior? Okay, so the claim is that if you consider a holographic model, a dilaton model, let's say you've solved for the dilaton field, and it gives a profile, it gives a modification of the bulk electromagnetism in this fashion. So it's no longer the standard electromagnetism you have in the bulk, but it's this y is now the radial coordinate, it's this coordinate. It's y to the a, f squared is your electromagnetism, and f is just dA. But these theories at the boundary give you a dimension for a which is not equal to 1. That's the claim by Karsh and Guttereau in a series of papers. Okay, and what I want to do is understand what exactly is entailed by this. Okay, now this is not manifestly breaking U1 symmetry. So there's no mass for the gauge field that has been introduced. It's just a dilaton field which screws up the dimension of what you mean by the vector potential. Okay, so how is this possible? So we've introduced this dilaton, which changes the physics along this radial direction. Radial direction is the RG direction. If we aren't breaking any symmetries, and holography really is about RG along the radial direction, then how can this possibly lead to an anomalous dimension? Because conserved quantities can't have a change in their dimension from doing RG. Okay, so let's look at the standard way that we think about the bulk boundary correspondence. So in this case, the gauge field in the bulk is just a source for a current at the boundary, and this gives rise to an action in which we have the parallel components of the gauge field just multiplying J. So in this case, there is no gauge structure added. There's no inherent gauge structure at the boundary that's implied. A is just a placeholder. It's just it's the source for the current, and you can generate all of the correlation functions by simply taking derivative with respect to A. Okay, so within the standard way of thinking about holography, we can't imbue A with any particular dimension. Okay, as I said, this boundary condition does not satisfy this. If, however, we are trying to understand how A can have anything other than dimension 1, what we really need is an alternative description in which the boundary theory really does have this property. And if it does have this, this means the bulk will be giving rise to a non-trivial gate structure at the boundary in either this Lifshitz geometry or the standard, just plain vanilla ADS. The boundary does lie at infinity, which means there will be a relationship between the boundary that sits off at infinity and whatever gauge structure the bulk had, which means this is really about a large gauge transformation. Okay, so what I'd like to do is construct this boundary theory explicitly. So what I'd like to do is just look at what the equations of motion are for this action. So I just differentiate with respect to A, and this is what the equations of motion look like. And what is interesting is that for any slice along this radial direction, this transformation is still true. But no, the moment I go to the boundary, y equals 0, this equation sort of becomes ambiguous, and I have to do something harder to understand what's the real gauge structure at the boundary. Okay, so to solve this problem, I want to appeal to a related math problem. Okay, so consider this differential equation in the xy plane, and x in general can be any number of coordinates. And I have some function which obeys a sort of elliptic differential equation. And this is just the Dirichlet boundary condition. And this is the equation that the differential equation, that g obeys. Del x is the Laplacian respect to x. Gy is first derivative, second derivative. Okay, and this differential equation can be rewritten in this form in a more economical fashion. So you know, it's not exactly just the Laplacian, okay? It's more complicated than that. Okay, so what I want to do is look at this quantity right here. So what you find, what was proven, is that any g that satisfies this differential equation, if you take the limit that y goes to 0, so you eliminate this coordinate, this quantity right here approaches this function, okay? So this differential equation, which looked very ordinary in the xy plane, the moment you remove one of these coordinates, namely y, you end up with a non-local relationship between, you end up with a non-local relationship on the Dirichlet boundary condition.
So C is just a number?
Yeah, C will depend on the dimension, and gamma is related to A in the following way. Gamma is 1 minus A over 2, okay? So this is the famous Caffarelli-Silvestri extension theorem, and it's relevant in this holographic setting because what we're doing in holography is exactly this. We're starting with something and eliminating one of the dimensions, and the thing we want to know here is what is the form of the operators that now are constrained to act on the boundary. So this is exactly the sort of thing I need to know how to do to solve my problem. Okay.
One question about the notation. You have minus the Laplacian. You mean you're considering the positive?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
In your previous slide, you had something similar, but without the minus sign. So
yeah, I know. So I'm just
confused if in one of these you have complex.
Okay, so look, eventually I go to the box operator. Okay. So this is a theorem which was proven in 2006, and we can't exactly use it here, okay? Let's take a closer look of what we actually need to go and do. So this is a scalar function, and so this is what Caffarelli and Silvestri showed us how to do. We have this differential equation, we eliminate the y direction, we end up with a non-local relationship at the boundary. Now, our equation looks like this. These are the equations of motion in the bulk of this system with this dilaton field. Now, they look very similar. But the thing of it is, this is a one form. So what I need to do is make the p-form generalization of the Caffarelli-Silvestri extension theorem. So I need to show that the Caffarelli-Silvestri extension theorem, which was only proven for a scalar field, really does work for a p-form. OK, we did that. And it's not a surprise. And so we did that in a math paper. And the result is that you end up with the current in A, in fact, are conjoined in a non-local relationship. OK, this should actually be gamma over 2, because this is now the Laplacian, and I've sort of used shorthand notation here. OK, so you end up with fractional Maxwell equations at the boundary. Yes.
So maybe this is a naive question, but these kind of non-local relations are, I think, pretty generic when you have mixed dimension theories. And so could you imagine having, you know, even without holography, you know, a lot of these high TC systems or layered systems, could you just have stuff propagating in the third dimension and that somehow leads to...
Okay, so that's a very good point. In fact, ways we were thinking about this at the very beginning. Formally, this was only known in 2006, so I'm surprised you say that these fractional Laplacians come
maybe
out.
Maybe just a few simple examples, like I think QED, you know.
Oh, right. Yes, that's right. Yeah, that's right. Right. But the thing here that we want, which is more general than the case in QED because it's constrained by the charge, is that this dilaton field allows you any particular dimension for A or J,
yeah,
okay?
I think it's like 3/2.
Yeah. There it's fixed, okay? What we want here is a way of engineering any possible dimension of A, okay? But ultimately, if I were to construct a microscopic theory that's really relevant for the cuprates, this multi-dimensionality and the fact that you might want to construct a theory in which the fields really lived here but might possibly extend, that's undoubtedly going to come into play. Yes?
I missed a little bit. Can you go back to the theorem for a second? Like the very beginning. Yeah, that. So what is the answer? The answer is, it's a statement about the solution on the boundary.
Yeah.
And the statement is what?
Is this.
That is the solution.
Yeah. But that's the form of the differential equation that you have to solve. In other words...
Well, sorry, that equal...
So the statement is, this limit here as y goes to 0 is in fact this.
Right, but this, there's no equal sign there. G equals to that?
Of that limit.
The limit, the y, there's an equal sign here and here.
Oh, I see.
And whereas g goes to f. Now, g goes to f, and that particular combination goes to Laplacian to the gamma.
Oh, right? I see.
Okay, so the reason why this is relevant is that this is the argument in the equations of motion.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yes.
So you probably need another boundary condition at y.
Yeah, of course. I mean, so very important. These are only bounded solutions, okay? So any bounded solution of this differential equation with this Dirichlet boundary condition has this property.
So g decays as...
Yeah, that's right. Those are the two conditions you need for Caffarelli-Silvestri to be true. Okay. Okay, So as I said, the reason why that's relevant is that this is the combination which occurs there. Okay, and now for our case, it's this with a one form. Well, actually it's now a two form because it's dA. Okay? Okay. So to be able to, and so what we did is we generalized this theorem to a P form, and the bottom line is this. Okay? Okay. So that's absolutely clear. You end up with these non-local relationships, and then you have the possibility then of engineering any dimension for A and J that you want. Okay, so let me just stop for a minute and just clarify something. I don't think it's correct to call this an anomalous dimension for the following reason. If in fact your bulk theory started off like this to begin with, because this has to have a fixed dimension, A didn't start off with dimension one. So it's not as if you're doing RG, this procedure of integrating along the radial coordinate is changing the dimension of A. It already had dimension one minus A over two. Okay? So it's really a non-traditional dimension because the bulk didn't have the standard electromagnetism. So that clarifies your question. Okay? Okay. Okay. Now, I need a further concept to really define the gauge transformation. I'm sorry this is sort of technical, but it's what you have to do if you're developing a fractional theory of electricity and magnetism. Okay, so you need to be able to define the fractional differential, and it's coming about from this combination here, where this really is the Laplacian raised to that power, and the star looks like this. So this combination is what enters here and here. So this maps a p-form to a p-form. As a result, this quantity here really does act like a, it just decreases the dimension by one. Okay? Okay, so which means that we can define an F, the curvature, the field strength, in terms of this fractional differential, which looks like this. And if we take this, integrate by parts, we'll end up with this. We can even, in fact, go the other way. So this construction really does give you an action which gives you those equations, those fractional equations of motion. So the general way of understanding that is through a field strength that doesn't have the standard behavior. Okay. Good. Now, the new gauge transformation will look like this. And this now has dimension gamma.
Okay, so
this is a general construction from dilettante theories that gives you the power to have any dimension for A and as a result, any dimension for J. And it's completely consistent and gauge invariant. It's just that the gauge transformation now looks like this weird thing. Okay, now you might ask the question, is there a problem with causality? There are two proofs that you can use to show that there is no problem with causality. So here I'm using box upper and the T enters with minus. Okay, so these are what the equations of motion look like. This commutes with this, and hence the eigenfunctions of this and this are related. In fact, they're the same ones, which means the eigenvalue equation just looks like this, which means that, in fact, omega is just equal to ck. You can also just go and point split operators at different points using the Caffarelli-Silvestri extension theorem, and you'll see that you also end up with a similar result. There is no superluminal transport in this problem. Okay. Now, so the current conservation, remember, I asked you, I said that a hint is that all of this is based on the fact that there's an ambiguity in what you mean by the current conservation equation. Okay, so the solution is, I've already alluded to. In fact, the Laplacian raised to any power, in this case we have fractional powers, commutes with the exterior derivative. And if that's the case, then that, in fact, redefines the current. Okay, now, I claim we sort of knew this. And it actually follows from Noether's second theorem. But let me just review something here. In general, the current-current correlator is of this form. And the standard Ward identity is this multiplies by this gives you zero. And this is just the conservation law. But if this is equal to zero, I can multiply also by this, and I will still get zero, which means there is a differential way of writing this statement, which is just this. These are exactly the conservation laws we currently have. And the importance is that they arise at a lower order in the hierarchy because they have fractional powers. Okay, so we started off by considering general ways in, I mean, a sort of generalized way of thinking about the gauge transformations. And this gives rise to a conservation law, which looks like this. And it occurs in a lower order in the hierarchy. Okay, now this is related to Noether's second theorem. Okay, Noether's second theorem came about from exactly this ambiguity, because Noether realized that the gauge transformations that you were considering didn't have to terminate at any particular point. In fact, the form of the conserved, the rank of the conserved charge, in fact, changes. And in her paper, she actually had all possible powers of derivatives here. If you stick with only integer derivatives, then if you have a conservation law, and now you say, well, it's ambiguous, any integer derivative on that will also give you zero. The non-trivial thing is if, in fact, you included here things which were not integer powers. And that is what the generalization is that we've constructed. Okay, now these sorts of points about Noether's second theorem are becoming more common now. In a very nice paper by Avery and Schwab, they in fact noticed this. And they said, you know, Noether, in fact, generalized this to involve any high order derivative. And then they said, although the authors know of no physically interesting examples. Okay, the case I gave you is dilaton action in ADS is exactly one case in which the effective gauge transformation is an example of this exception that Noether was talking about. Okay, now, is this just a game? I mean, can you really, if you have currents, you really have to be able to show that they satisfy a proper algebra. Okay, and one can do that. So let me just review the standard Virasoro algebra. The generators just look like this. And there's a commutator, which just maps the circle to itself. And then there's a central extension. Okay, and it's just this. Okay, this conformal mappings of the unit disk. Okay, now in this case, the generators are very different. They involve fractional derivatives. Okay, now there's an important point here. The fractional Laplacian, so the Laplacian on some function.
Sorry, why are we talking about Virasoro all of a sudden?
Because I wanted to construct a current algebra for fractional currents.
Algebra for fraction, but okay. But why the Virasoro algebra?
What other algebra would you want me to construct?
Oh, you're talking about the U1 gauge field, no?
Yeah, that's right. But the I can still. So my point is that even if I were to construct the generators in Virasoro out of these fractional objects, I would still end up with an algebra that had the basic structure with the central extension. Yeah, I'm not saying these are U1 objects, okay? Okay. Okay, let me just write this down. Okay, so this is what the general Laplacian is. And note, this vanishes when f is equal to zero, when f is a constant. But if you were to take, for example, this quantity is this, the standard fractional derivative will give you something which is non-zero, even if the function is a constant. But that's not true for the Laplacian. Okay, and that is an inherent problem if, for example, the gauge theory were based on the fractional derivative rather than the fractional differential, which is based on the fractional Laplacian. Okay, so you can construct an algebra for these fractional objects, and it does have a central extension, and this is the coset group that everything is in. Okay. Now, is there a hidden symmetry? Which would relate this then, this non-local relationship between J and A, will relate it then, possibly, to the Pippard case. Okay, in fact, there is. If I started in the bulk with a theory which just had, in which I gave the gauge field along the radial direction a mass, I could use the Caffarelli-Silvestri extension theorem, and I would end up with a boundary theory that looked like this. And this power here is related to the mass of this field. So only along in this extra dimension have I actually broken U1, but the boundary knows about this because this mass is coupling to the current at the boundary. Okay, so the point of it is now, so this is like a dynamical Higgs mode, but it's only acting in the bulk, but it's coupled to the current, and it's giving rise to the same answer. So whether or not you start with a dilaton theory or a massive field just along the y direction, you'll end up with the same theory. So my point now is that a mass in the IR will give rise to a current, and hence this non-locality that we're ending up with is really a sign that there is some breaking of U1. In the case of superconductivity, it's a real breaking. In this case, it's in some higher dimensional construct. Okay, now, if the strange metal really is tied to an anomalous dimension for the gauge field, and that's a fairly striking claim, and there should be profound experimental consequences, one of which I mentioned already, that one has a problem defining the flux. Okay, there are a couple of things I want to point out. Okay, one is the standard skin effect, or just the length scale over which electromagnetism penetrates something, is really tied to the fact that the Maxwell equations are second order. And that's what the square root is, the resistivity, the frequency, and the permittivity in a vacuum. Okay, in this case, these are the equations. And so everything's going to change now. This penetration depth will, not to penetrate, this skin depth will now scale like this. Okay, so it's a different relationship between, and it's tied to this power. So this is not something that is particularly hard to test, just in the strange metal, is the skin, just do the frequency-dependent skin depth measurement, and you should be able to see if, in fact, it's the standard power of 1/2 or if it's something modified.
Which of the quantities inside the parentheses changes the dimension so that delta has the dimensions of length? You're talking about skin depth. I'm assuming that's a dimensionful parameter, right?
Right. So,
but you also have to modify what the permittivity is in your magnetism.
I don't want to give you the wrong answer. Okay. Right. It's, let me get back to you on that, okay? Because that's a very good question. If everything has the standard dimensions, then of course there's a, right. Okay. Now, let's go to the more profound issue. How do you define the magnetic flux in a system in which pi r squared b, remember this is the b that is sourced by an a that doesn't have dimension one. So this doesn't have dimension two, which means this quantity doesn't have the units to be the flux. Another way of saying this is that it seems like the charge, what you mean by the charge, is not really what you mean by the charge. Okay. Right. In fact, this case, it's this quantity right here. So what's the resolution? Okay. So what you have to do is construct something that you can put into a covariant derivative. And this is the problem that Leo was having. You need to construct something that you can put into a covariant derivative which does have the correct units. Okay, so these are the equations of motion. And this defines the current. And a statement of what I just told you is that this quantity here defines the B field. So there is a relationship, and A is just this thing right here, which is this. I'm just looking at the spatial part of this acting on this. Okay, so there is a Stokes law that allows you to go from here to here. But the point of it is this quantity doesn't have the right dimensions. So it's telling you that whatever flux this is measuring, the effective charge is not an integer. Okay, so in other words, there's a non-integer number of hc over e, which you can interpret as a lack of charge quantization. Okay, so what you have to do now, to be able to define this correctly, you have to be able to construct a covariant derivative. And to do that, you have to define an A, which is a fictitious gauge field, which removes this dimension that you had of gamma, or in this case alpha, from your underlying fractional gauge field. And you can do that with this transformation. So this is the fractional integral, which undoes all of the stuff having to do with the fractional Laplacian. And underneath that now will be a theory which will transform like this, because this A does have dimension one, as it has to, if it's in fact going into a covariant derivative. Okay, this will be the phase. And so this quantity right here is just the fractional Laplacian raised to the negative power, which means this quantity will now have dimension one. We'll have zero, and then this will fix the dimension of that. So the question I want to ask is now, consider this A, which is related to the fractional A, with this Laplacian. What's the relationship between this quantity integrated over a line and this quantity? Okay, so this is the one that you want to say you can stick into a covariant derivative to calculate the flux. What's the relationship with this thing, which is actually the physical one, which has the anomalous dimension? Okay, now the relationship here will tell you whether or not this quantity is quantized or this one. Okay, here's the relationship. Okay, so in general, this quantity is not an integer, which means either this one or this can be quantized, but not both of them simultaneously. Which means it's really telling you that the charge is not quantized in this system in which you have these fractional Maxwell equations. At least the one that in fact will measure anything like a phase. Okay, so then...
Can you go back 1 second? But is it consistent with dimensional analysis because...
Yeah, absolutely. That's in fact how this was constructed, okay?
Because given the first line up there, capital A and little a have different dimensions, no?
Yeah, but let me just tell you something. So, right. So there should be this here. I'm sorry. Okay? In other words, this quantity right here and this quantity are related with this gamma function. Okay, but this should be A tilde, which is this whole quantity right here. Okay? Okay. Okay. So the real question is this gauge field, which has to do with the fractional stuff, and the one that you can stick into a covariant derivative that has the standard dimension. How do you quantize these? What's a dot dl for both of them? Okay, and one or the other can be quantized, but not both. Okay, so this means now that the phase that you would encounter if you looked at the flux through here will not be the standard result of pi r squared b, because this does not have the standard units. It has to be multiplied by something else to make this into a flux, a physical flux, which means now that the charge is going to depend on this outer radius. And this is all coming about because you had a non-local relationship between the current and the gauge field. Okay, so this is a prediction that if in fact the strange metal has this property, then the Aronov-Bohm phase is no longer the standard thing. Okay, so this correction is not small. Yeah, I know, I'm finishing up here. It's certainly possible to, I think, do this kind of experiment, either this or the skin depth experiment. So if you just took a superconductor in the normal state now, just any of these high TC materials, you're seeing that the non-locality is manifested in the fact that the phase depends on the outer radius. And it doesn't seem like it's an unrealistic experiment. If you look at these, the Planckian timescales, they aren't so unreasonable from what they would be in any other kind of metal. And hence, I would argue this is entirely a reasonable experiment. Okay, so my point now is the strange metal has this non-local kernel, and this is feeding into this non-locality is different in the strange metal than it is in, aluminum, and it's affecting now what you would see for the Meissner effect down here. And the key thing here is that this is being established, this non-locality, because these systems are strongly correlated, this non-locality is manifest at much higher temperatures. Okay, so my last transparency. Okay, so if in fact the strange metal really does have A not having dimension one, then the underlying electricity and magnetism really does look very different. It's the only way of constructing things which don't have dimension one. And you still have causality and the Pippard kernel, which is a way of thinking about this in general, is another example of this kind of physics. Okay.
In this non-local Gaussian theory
that you define,
is it really true that commutators vanish outside the electron?
The what?
That commutators vanish outside the electron?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. That does
not matter at all. So, what you want. The radial coordinate?
No radial coordinate, no, just this theory where you get A boxed to some power, A is the Lagrangian.
Oh, so I was going to show you in the, from the holographic.
No, the CFT dual to the holographic theory, for example, with the Dilaton gradient, is certainly a local CFT.
Yeah.
But it's not just this Gaussian theory with the non-local.
What I'm trying to show you is that even with that, you can show that, in fact, it is. Because you can, this operator is none other than y to the a partial y phi. Okay, so if you take y to the a with the other thing at x prime, and just take this limiting process, you'll end up with this raised to this power on phi of x, phi of x prime, which is just delta of x minus x prime, which means you'd have this operator acting on that, which gives you zero. So I'm saying even in the Gaussian theory, you still don't have any problem. Yes.
Do you also have a local stress tensor operator, conserved stress tensor?
Local conserved stress tensor. Okay, so that's sort of problem. We haven't constructed it. So I don't want to tell you anything I haven't calculated. Okay? I know what the equations of motion are. I know what the new conservation law is, but I haven't formulated that in terms of a stress tensor.
Okay, let's go up again.